all bad things.
Tragedies, disasters. Bad things.
Trigger warning for everything possible.
What?
Hello. I'm Rachel.
And I'm David.
And this is All Bad Things.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome.
Follow us, Insta, Twitter, at X, Facebook, TikTok, Twitch, at All Bad Things Pod. Email us allbadthingspod@gmail.com. Join our Facebook discussion group, our Discord, and our subreddit.
Do all those things.
Yes.
I'm guessing if you just put twitter.com into, which everybody uses apps these days, nobody really uses
it
the internet.
It probably just redirects.
That's what I'm guessing, yeah. And most people still call it, like, a retweet, okay? Like, it's a simple thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
A re-X?
A rex.
A rex? You know? I mean, it really, like, I didn't have much of an opinion on Elon Musk before this whole takeover thing. Mm-hmm. I was just like, you know, probably thought the same thing. Oh, like, he's bringing electric cars. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
You know?
Is it?
Well, I mean, he did, like, one of the few good things he's done, I guess, is, like, make it so that electric cars aren't so scary, like, they're available. Like,
I suggest listening to the dollop about Elon Musk.
Oh, I have, yeah. Okay. It's not, he didn't create it. Like, no, he's like, but this whole, like, was it Bill Burr? He was like, this whole takeover, like, shows you just, like, how incompetent, like, people with billions of dollars can be. He's like, because when you accrue that much money, he's like, you don't do anything anymore. He's like, what do you do?
And like, and it doesn't matter if you lose a whole bunch of money, because first of all, it's not yours.
Right.
Because billionaires aren't risking their own money.
Right. And they've got it tied up in assets that are tied up through these assets. And, like, it's not like he's liquid $100 billion. That would be kind of obscene.
Yeah.
But, like, it kind of reminds, like, one of my best friends is an executive chef.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk to him occasionally, you know, ask him, like, oh, how's the food business going and this and that? He's like, well, he's like, I don't really cook anymore.
Yeah.
He's like, because he's doing all the management stuff.
Hence executive.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's like, yeah, I'll hop on to help out somebody every now and then or get things going. He's like, but I'm not doing.
He's management.
Right.
He's high,
like,
level management.
He's like, but I'm not making sauces and doing all this stuff that I used to do. He's like,
yeah.
And, like, Elon Musk is probably in that same.
Well,
like,
he was never
making the sauce.
Yes.
But he was probably making, you know, more executive decisions than he's making now. And it's just, I don't know. It's just, nobody should have that amount of money.
Yeah.
Or power. Both.
Yeah. Speaking of making the sauce.
Yeah.
I want to have a pod discussion.
Okay.
So we are going to hit episode 350. Next week.
My God.
Next
episode.
I know. Well, speaking of Elon Musk, let's talk about Ronald Reagan. No, not exactly, but something very close to him. So, anyway, we've got a listener script this week, of course, right? We knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And any guesses who it's by? Got our usual suspects.
Well, I mean, it's by one of three or four people, so.
If you had to pick one of them, who would you guess?
Just tell me. Steven.
Yes!
Okay.
You got it. Yeah. You got it. That's exactly right. Yes. It is Steven. So, this is the story of Operation Eagle Claw. Have you ever heard of this?
Mm-mm.
I have not either. So, Steven's sources are Wikipedia, Operation Eagle Claw 1980 by Justin W. Williamson, Encyclopedia Britannica, the Airborne and Specialist Operation Museum website. So, I did look at this just so that I had a slight orientation of what this is. And I'm very pleased with this because a point in history that I'm very interested in is the Carter years, the Carter administration years.
Sure.
Because I think it was just such a pivotal time. And this is one of the pivotal events.
Turned out to be.
Yes. This is one of, surrounding one of the pivotal events of that time and sort of one of the linchpins of the Reagan victory of 1980. So, specifically the Iran hostage crisis.
I was going to say, it has to have something to do with Iran. And...
Mm-hmm. So while the history of the people of Iran goes back over 4,000 years, I'm not going to spend much time on it. We kind of have touched on some of Iran's history in previous episodes, I think.
We've been there before, mm-hmm. I think, in, was there a flood or an earthquake or a something?
There's definitely been something.
Something's yes. happened there.
Yes, some things have happened in Iran.
I want to say it was maybe the focal point for the Year Without a Summer?
Mm-mm.
No?
No, that was Krakatoa.
No, but the country that was, I don't know, whatever. But people are aware of Iran.
Yes, I think we've heard of Iran. Yes. While it is interesting, most of it is not relevant to what happened in this disaster. In 642, so we're not going back 4,000 years, but we are going back about 1,500, Umar ibn al-Khattab, then caliph of the Muslims, ordered a full-scale invasion of Persia by the Rashidun army, which led to the complete conquest of the Sasanian Empire by 651. Did you like the confidence with which I said those words?
Sure.
Thank you.
Gotta be.
I have no idea if I said them right. At first, the local population rejected the invaders' religion, but over many years, the Muslim religion spread widely through the country. The Iranian government claimed that in 2011, 99.98% of all Iranians were Muslim. That's almost everybody.
Yeah. That's about, like, as a sample size, that's as close as you can get to 100%,
yes, pretty much. Yes, it is. Other agencies based outside Iran have suggested that the real number of people who identify as Muslim could be as low as 40%. There is no real way to get an accurate count in a country that has a government that doesn't separate the church from the state. Hey, it's hard to get an accurate count in any census or survey, but yeah. Though Persia declared itself neutral at the beginning of the First World War, it was strategically important to both sides of the conflict. Britain was in the process of converting its navy over from coal to oil, and Persia had started exporting oil just a couple of years before the war started. I didn't know that.
Well, here's the thing. Because World War I was really the first mechanized war, where you needed oil and gasoline, after it was over with, that was the goal for every country.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where can we get this black gold?
Right.
We turned our heads towards Saudi Arabia. Because that hadn't been tapped yet. But yes, since Iran was already producing, then yes, it would make sense that the European countries would be like,
yeah.
You, over there.
Yeah.
With the oil.
Hey, you with the oil.
Yeah.
Come here.
We need that. But yeah, that was a big reason why Germany was going to lose the war anyway, but that was a big reason why, other than attrition, like, they just didn't have, they were just out of the resources. Population. Well, no, they were just...
Or resources, actually.
Yeah, they were really just out of resources. I mean, all the European nations were pretty much out of troops.
Yeah.
But they, and that's what they, by the time World War II comes along, what is Germany's main focus? Automation, or not automation, mechanized warfare everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not making that mistake again.
Right.
They're going to have more planes, more submarines, more everything than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. By the end of the Great War, go ahead. Parts of Persia were occupied by the British, Russian, after the Russian Revolution, the Soviets, and the Ottoman Empire. The Persian famine of 1917 to 1919 killed almost half of the Iranian people.
Really? Jeez.
Famines, I'll tell you, famines will kill people faster than, like, just about anything. I mean...
Yeah. If you have a famine, people just die.
Yeah, imagine.
I mean, really.
Imagine people don't get fed and they die. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
Occupying armies requisitioned locally produced food, and droughts and poor harvests made matters worse. Starvation, cholera, and the plague took their toll before the 1918 flu pandemic came along and made matters worse. If it wasn't for the fact that this was really a war crime, it would be suitable for its own episode of All Bad Things. That is the hard part about famines. Most of them are essentially like genocides.
Yeah. So. I mean, yeah.
In February 1921, the British backed a coup d'etat by Reza Khan, and before long, he had become a virtual dictator. He appointed himself Shah on December 13th, 1925. In 1935, the country changed its name from Persia to Iran. Due to the experiences of the Iranian people during the First World War, Iran's sympathies leaned towards the Nazis. Germany hadn't occupied Iranian territory, and the memories of how things had been under British and Soviet control was still fresh in the minds of the local population. The Shah decided Iran's neutrality at the beginning of the Second World War. He was uncomfortable with the Nazi race policy, yeah, but the British had treated the Iranians so badly that he couldn't forget the past. I can see that.
Like, imagine being treated so awfully that you turn to the Nazis.
Well, to be fair, to be fair, they didn't. They did not.
Well, consider it.
to not instantly take the other side.
Yeah, like, you know, they want to kill all the Jews. Like, we're down with that because we're Muslims. Like, so we're good on that term.
Just a position statement here. We don't believe that all Muslims want Jews dead.
To be clear. I'm speaking of the government.
Okay.
The government certainly had that sentiment. But yeah. Just imagine being like...
That's a hot topic right now, you know?
But just imagine being like... I mean, but India has the same story about the Brits. I mean,
everyone's got a beef with the British. Yes. Just like everybody's got a beef with the Americans, you know?
I don't think as much as with the British. We're not there quite yet. We're getting there. Yeah. We're trying. We're doing our best.
They had a big head start.
Yeah, they did.
You know.
To be fair, they did. That's the head start is why they're still ahead.
Yes.
We've made up a lot of ground in like the last, I don't know, like just like 40 years. Right. We've made up, you know, pretty much all the ground.
We will be the most hated country in the world. The British backed Iran's prime minister, Mohammad al-Faruqi, to demand the removal of Reza Shah. They knew that his son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, was pro-British. On September 16, 1941, Reza Shah abdicated. He fled to South Africa and died 3 years later. 4 months after taking power, his son signed a treaty with the Soviet Union and Great Britain. Both countries agreed to protect the Iranian government and to withdraw their troops 6 months after the end of the war. Iran joined the war against the Germans on September 9th, 1943. The Soviets and the British both ignored their promises to Iran.
No.
Right? And soon the country was flooded with Polish refugees from Russia. The Allies seized food and fuel, and soon the Iranian people suffered. Between 1942 and 1943, 4 million Iranians died of starvation or typhus.
Jesus.
The Soviets didn't withdraw their troops at the end of the Second World War, and the Shah had to appeal to the United Nations to get them out of his country. In 1951, Mohammad Mossadegh became the prime minister.
Mossadegh?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This person is very key to our relation with Iran.
Gotcha. Became the prime minister of Iran. He nationalized the oil industry. Mm-hmm. This pissed off the British and the Americans. How rude is it to want to benefit from your own national resources? His government introduced compensation for the unemployed, benefits for sick and injured workers, and the Land Reform Act that made landlords pay a 20% tax to fund things like public baths, rural housing, and pest control. Can we please institute a 20% tax on landlords?
Well, and let's also pause right there because you can look at photos from this brief time. Mm-hmm. In Iranian history, Mossadegh had an admiration for the United States.
Okay.
Because of all the, you know, propaganda and stuff, he was looking at the United States. That's a country that knows how to be free. They know how to do it. We want to be that.
Okay.
In the Eastern slash Western world.
Middle Eastern.
Mm-hmm. Right. So yes, they very much tried to model. He tried to model. Iranian democracy around American democracy, the same thing. Like, oh, well, because you have to also remember in America, this is when, just after FDR had passed, but this is when all the social programs are starting to flood into the U.S. Mm-hmm. for the first time. He's trying to do the same thing there. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he's going to get into, like, what we did with that. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, like... Like, no, we were just interested in the oil. Like,
we didn't want you to actually institute democracy here.
Like, yeah, like, where exactly was the disconnect?
We wanted you to do what we want you to do, you see.
Yes.
In 1953, Britain and America launched Operation Ajax. The government might have been democratically elected, but it had socialist tendencies. The British were pissed off that they might have to pay a fair price for their fuel, and they convinced the Americans that Iran might become communist. The Soviet Union shared a border with Iran. The only option was, what we do best in the United States to other countries, a coup d'etat.
Mm-hmm.
A right-wing dictator had to be better than a democratically elected government. Mohammad Mossadegh was a popular leader, so the CIA bribed the local newspapers to print false articles saying the prime minister had Jewish heritage.
This is all declassified stuff.
Okay.
All this became declassified about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this sense. Is all, like, confirmed, this shit mm-hmm. happened.
This is not in conspiracy theory
no.
territory. This isn't fully admitted.
No, he's not getting this information from some guy on Facebook.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like, this is information you can get.
It might not be true, but prejudiced people aren't known for their fact-checking ability. They also organized fake protests and assassinated various religious leaders, but that backed the legitimate government. After the coup, Iran was run as a dictatorship. The Shah pushed for the swift westernization and secularization of the country. This made it look like he was a puppet for America and Britain. The problem is that authoritarian dictators can only last so long before any other alternative looks like an improvement. Something we'll probably learn in a few years. The Iranian people...
More like 8 months.
...were sick... Well, no, I was saying the idea authoritarian dictators only last so long before any other alternative looks like an improvement.
Oh, I
see. We need the dictator first, you know. I mean, we already had him, but anyway. The Iranian people were sick of overseas interference in their country's affairs. The Shah was trying to westernize Iran very quickly, and the economy was failing. Yeah, welcome to capitalism. His government was corrupt. Protests were dealt with harshly by his secret police and the army, giving Ayatollah Khomeini and others a chance to gain popularity. Mm-hmm. By the 16th of January, 1979,
your second birthday.
Civil unrest was getting so bad that the Shah left Iran. Once a country has overthrown a legally elected and popular government, it isn't a big deal to overthrow an unpopular, corrupt one. Maybe something to keep in mind.
Oh, the Iranians, as well as... We've rinse repeated on this like 20 times since then.
No, I mean in the United States.
Well, yeah.
The Iranians, as well as Khomeini's followers, saw their chance and took over the country.
Yep.
On the 1st of February, the Ayatollah returned to Iran. At this stage, it was not a foregone conclusion that the next government would be run on purely religious grounds. The interim government wasn't completely anti-American, but it was wise enough to be wary of the USA. Everyone should be wary of the USA. On February 14th, 1979, 1979 was a big year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Man.
For a lot of things. Yeah.
Yeah. A group of people who called themselves the Organization of Iranian People's Fedai Guerrillas broke into the American embassy and took a U.S. Marine hostage. See, I'm fascinated by this period in time, but I don't know all the details about it, so this is interesting to learn.
Yeah.
The American staff knew that things could escalate quickly, and there was a standing order that force shouldn't be used to defend the embassy. The ambassador surrendered, and the interim Iranian government negotiated the Marines' release 6 days later. One of the reasons that America was targeted was because Jimmy Carter had shown his support for the Shah before. The embassy was evacuated as much as possible, and a skeleton staff was left behind. Can you imagine being one of the poor people? Okay, I'll just be here.
Well, they would become...
Yeah, the hostages,
mm-hmm.
yes. Ruhollah Khomeini was a religious cleric that headed one of the rebel groups opposing the Shah. Western countries had behaved so badly that his idea that the Islamic region was under attack seemed valid. The West knows him as Ayatollah Khomeini. Ayatollah is a term for a high-level cleric. Khomeini had denounced America and the Shah. He was arrested in 1964. After he was released, he went into exile. I do remember hearing about that. He recorded tapes and had them smuggled into Iran. On November the 4th, 1979, a group of between 300 to 500 Iranian students invaded the embassy. At 10:30 in the morning, protesters started climbing the outer walls. embassy staff started to destroy classified documents. Oh boy. Six of them then retreated to the Canadian embassy. What an American thing to do.
Well, it's what the
Argo.
Yeah, that's what that's about this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just after midday, the building was under control of the Iranians. 66 people were captured. The American Marines still had standing orders not to open fire, and that probably saved many lives on both sides of the incident.
Well, I mean, you get 300 to 500 people, there's a couple of Marines. Like, yeah, if you open fire, yeah, you'll get a couple people, but you're not going to get everybody, and you'll get overwhelmed even quicker.
Yeah. The Americans and some of the students thought that the occupation would be a repeat performance of the previous invasion. The protesters were loyal to Khomeini, but the Ayatollah hadn't taken much notice of the students' actions. So that would suck. Being like, hey, look! Like, huh? What?
Well, we took over this U.S. embassy again!
We're here!
For you.
Notice me!
Shout out! Can I get a like?
Something? Hashtag! Hashtag! Yeah. Disco at the embassy!
Can I get a retweet, maybe? Yeah, boy. Imagine if all this shit's going on during social media. Like, seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. While the religious leader found out about the embassy, he didn't endorse their occupation immediately. It was only after he had taken the time to gauge the reaction of the public that he backed his supporters. That makes sense. Like, let me get a little temperature here. Okay, all right.
Does the public want to kill Americans? Yes. Okay. Here's your,
all right, we'll go along.
Here's your like and your retweet.
Yeah, we got a like. There is no doubt that his stand on the occupation of the embassy helped influence the voting in the referendum. During the last 2 days of March 1979, a referendum to replace the monarchy with an Islamic republic was held, and the vote was 98% in favor of the change. Ruhollah Khomeini stated that the new government was God's government, and any disagreement with him or the new government was blasphemy. Again, sounds pretty familiar.
Which god? Ruhollah? Or Ayatollah? What is his name again?
Ruhollah Khomeini.
Rola.
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 R-U-O-L-L-A-H. Yes. I could be mispronouncing that, but...
Rola.
Rola. I like that better. When the Iranian Revolution began, over 10,000 U.S. citizens were evacuated to safety, but 66 Americans remained in the American embassy. The Shah's health was deteriorating, and President Jimmy Carter was pressured to let him into the USA for medical treatment.
Oh, yeah.
The Ayatollah wasn't a fan of America already, allowing the Shah...
Pissed him off even more.
Yeah, allowing the Shah into the United States was seen as proof that Jimmy Carter was conspiring to overthrow the new regime. In 1961, the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations states that, quote, the person of a diplomatic agent shall be inviolable. He shall not be liable to any form of arrest or detention. The receiving state shall treat him with due respect and shall take all appropriate steps to prevent any attack on his person, freedom, or dignity, end quote. That's diplomatic immunity, I think. This meant that it was up to the Iranians to get the protesters to release the American diplomats. Iran released 13 hostages the next day. Oh, okay. America issued warnings to Iran that if the hostages were put on trial, they may take military action.
Trial, I think you mean.
Sorry. It was just a typo, so yeah. Yes, trial. I was like, I'm going to guess this means something. No, I gotcha. On trial, yeah, they may take military action. Jimmy Carter started negotiations to have the hostages released. Planning began on a rescue mission on the 12th of November. The code name for the mission was Operation Rice Bowl. What?
That doesn't sound very inspiring.
No. It sounds both...
Come on, guys, we're getting together for Operation Rice Bowl.
It sounds both boring and racist. I can't tell, like, what they were
it
trying
to do. It
sounds
like a
there.
Mission during Vietnam.
Which is also racist, but yes.
But, you know.
Or it sounds like a bowl game, a bad bowl game, like, for football.
Oh, yeah, that's, yeah, exactly.
Rice Bowl.
Yeah, it's like,
welcome to the Rice Bowl.
Yeah, between two colleges that people barely acknowledge exist. But, right. But they both had 6 wins, so we got to give them a bowl game. Mm-hmm.
Rescue exercises were started straight away. It soon became quite obvious that the Iranians were not interested in a diplomatic resolution. They used the pretext that it was students holding the hostages, not the Iranian government. But the Iranian government, again, liked and retweeted it, so. There were military options available to Jimmy Carter. He could have had Iranian oil fields bombed or harbors mined, but the Iranians could kill the hostages. An even worse scenario for Carter would have been if they started killing some of their prisoners and keeping others alive. Three attempts were made to negotiate with the Iranians, but the hardliners in control vetoed all three attempts. A rescue team was assembled from four different branches from the military. Members came from the Army, Air Force, Marines, and the CIA. That's it sounds like a dangerous combination. They spent months training together and planning the best way to save the hostages. 118 assault troops were to be flown in on C-130 Hercules aircraft. A makeshift base was to be set up and the helicopters would fly in, load up, and launch the final phase of the rescue. The rescue mission was named Operation Eagle Claw. That's better. I mean, it's aggressively American. It's
way better than Rice
Bowl. But it's better than Rice Bowl, yes. The moment that training started, there were problems. Some helicopter pilots had to be removed from the mission after they nearly flew into a mountain. Yeah, you want to probably weed those pilots out. Time was also a problem. As the longer training took, the more likely it was that the Iranians might find out about the plan. Yeah, and also, there's hostages, guys! Just embassy. This was the first deployment of the newly formed Delta Force, but the training they had undertaken was for completely different scenarios.
It's a great series of movies starring, is it Chuck Norris?
I think it was Chuck Norris.
Yeah.
Is it about the Delta Force?
Probably.
Military?
I mean, they all came out in the 80s when, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was
when just... it was the 80s, yes. Yeah. On December 4th, hostage takers announced that they will prosecute 8 of the hostages. Ooh. 22 days... Yes, Demetrius. 22 days later, 6 CH-53 Sea Stallion helicopters were loaded on the USS Kitty Hawk to be transferred to the USS Nimitz later. The Sea Stallion, built by Sikorsky, is a heavy-lift helicopter. It became operational in 1966. The 6 embassy staff that had escaped the Canadian embassy flew out of Tehran using fake Canadian passports on the 28th of January, 1980. Nice. Is that the... Mm-hmm. That's the Argo people.
Yep.
Okay, yeah, that's right. 17 days later, a group of American hostages were lined up in front of a firing squad for a mock execution. Okay, That's not good. The Sea Stallions didn't have enough range to fly the mission without refueling. Rubber fuel tanks would have to be loaded into fixed-wing aircraft and used to extend the range of the helicopters. The fixed-wing aircraft selected to support the mission was the C-130 Combat Talon. This is a modified Hercules that has been modified for special operations missions. The plan was to fly in on the first night, land in the middle of nowhere, and wait until the next night to fly to the embassy and rescue the hostages. The USS Nimitz, which I feel like we've talked about before, because maybe. I recognize the name.
It does sound familiar. It's quite possible. We are on our 349th episode.
Yes, we are. The USS Nimitz and the USS Coral Sea were moved into position. On the 24th of April, 1980, the mission was launched. The fixed-wing component of the mission took off from Egyptian airfields, carrying the troops and fuel. 3 Hercules aircraft full of troops and fuel headed off to the staging area. The plan was for the planes to arrive first and set up everything for the helicopters. One of the C-130s landed roughly, and the aircraft was damaged. The radar in the plane had seen a truck heading towards the staging area. A soldier fired an anti-tank rocket-propelled grenade launcher at the vehicle. Okay. The truck exploded and the driver jumped out and ran to another vehicle that had been following the first machine and they took off into the desert. Ooh, that's sketchy. A ranger hopped on a motorcycle and gave chase, but the truck got away. A few minutes later, a bus came along. The rescue team shot holes in the engine block. 44 Iranians were taken prisoner. The bus was pushed clear of the landing strip. So they're just like throwing rockets and taking people prisoner just for being in the vicinity of their staging area.
Yeah.
Okay? This was supposed to be in the middle of an empty desert. No one realized that the site picked was near a major roadway. So they were basically, people doing whatever they were doing and having these crazy Americans launch grenades at them and basically take them hostage, take them prisoner.
In order, driving
on a roadway.
In order to save people who have been taken hostage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes American sense.
But it's also like the broader scope. You look at like people don't. Certainly the European governments, our own government, like we don't care about like the. They're like, oh, they're just Iranians. Like,
right.
They don't have roads or major cities, although we know that they have those things. Like,
of course.
Like, how can you not take that into account?
Yeah.
Like, we have, I mean, it's...
We have maps back in 1980.
And we also have satellites. Yes. That can, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. spy satellites, which I'm sure we're using on these areas. It's right? Like, nobody figured that out. Like, hey, like, this is, like, just a major road.
Could you not see? Like, do you see that there's pavement or that there's
like imagine if you're going down like or... Interstate 40 one day and like somebody's like all these vehicles are getting jacked and so you're just like what the fuck is like is it World War III?
Right. The burning truck lit up the sky. The other Hercules landed on the temporary airfield and the gear for refueling the helicopters was set up. The helicopters were running an hour late and they needed to be camouflaged and refueled before sunrise. 8 helicopters took off from the Nimitz and flew over the ocean at 200 feet to keep below the Iranian radar. Their navigation systems started to give problems soon after launching the operations. Hercules C-130s flew overhead and could see on their radar that there were sandstorms ahead, but strict radio silence stopped the two teams from communicating to each other. Two hours after takeoff, a warning light came up on one Sea Stallion. The pilot flying the aircraft had a different system than the one he was used to. He thought the light meant that it was a warning light indicating a problem that could cause a sudden rotor blade failure. The pilot landed rather than taking the chance that his helicopter might crash. On landing, the aircraft sank into the soft sand. Another helicopter picked up the aircrew, and they abandoned the down chopper and carried on 15 minutes behind the rest of the mission. So they just abandoned somewhere there's just this helicopter in a bunch of quicksand or soft sand. The helicopters were flying low and in a tight formation. The C-130 fixed-wing aircraft had flown through several sandstorms without any problems, but helicopters can't cope as well with fine sand and dust. When the first small sandstorm hit, they spread out to avoid colliding with each other. The next sandstorm was far larger, and soon the helicopter pilots were flying almost blind. That's not good. Mm. One Sea Stallion turned back to report on the deteriorating situation. Fine dust entered the cockpit of the choppers, and visibility was reduced to zero. The decision was made to carry on with the mission. All the helicopters lost contact with each other, and with radio silence being in place, they just had to carry on independently. They were flying blind a few hundred feet above the ground, and they knew there was a 3,000-foot-high mountain somewhere in front of them. Like, what? What? I know, right? Right, Demetrius? I am calling them sandstorms, but that is a bit simplistic. They are really a mix of airborne sand and fine dust. The Iranians call them haboobs.
Oh, haboob.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Where have you heard that?
That's just their name for a sandstorm.
Like I did not know that. Yeah. Okay. Just when it seemed things couldn't get worse, one Sea Stallion developed an oil leak and another one was having electrical failures. Oh, could it possibly be the sandstorms they're flying through? One pilot made the decision to abort the mission and head back to the Nimitz. The minimum number of helicopters considered necessary to complete the mission successfully was 6, and that was all the Americans had left. So now they can't lose anymore, or they can't complete the mission. The C-130s had left their engines running because the pilots were scared they may not be able to start them again if they shut them down. The choppers were now 90 minutes overdue. The first helicopter landed hard and damaged its landing gear. The Sea Stallion, with failing hydraulics, made it to the staging area. The six remaining choppers were refueled. The helicopter pilots were not happy, and they suggested that the mission needed to be canceled.
Yeah.
Yeah. The turning propellers and rotor blades blew the sand everywhere, and tempers flared. You know, men are so emotional. You know, if women were in charge, it could be a lot of these emotional men. The turning propellers and rotor blades... I already said that. The pilots resented the mission leader suggesting that they were scared. He had flown in on the Hercules, so he had no idea just how bad the sandstorms had been. Before the mission could start its next stage, the backup pump for the flight controls on one of the remaining helicopters failed. The chopper was no longer safe to use. The decision was made to abort the mission. The plan was to fly out after destroying any equipment left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they also intended to leave fake documents to make it look like a Soviet mission, but this didn't happen. The bulk of the assault force was loaded into the Hercules aircraft. As the first helicopter took off, the dust got so bad that the pilot couldn't see a C-130 still on the ground. The Sea Stallion's main rotor hit the aircraft below.
Oops. Oh, jeez.
The chopper hit the ground and it went up in a huge fireball. The C-130 was caught in the blast and caught fire as well. Five airmen and three Marines were killed in the conflagration.
Jeez.
Jesus. So, like, this mission is too dangerous now and we can't complete it. We need to abort. And now eight people are going to die.
Mm.
Jesus. Like, this is going to be a, this isn't going to turn out well no matter what. Many men on board the Hercules managed to escape before the whole aircraft went up in flames. The ammunition on the plane started to cook off. Four men were badly burned and the remaining aircraft had to take off to avoid getting damaged from the explosions from the burning wrecks. Jeez. Yeah, and it's like, we're trying not to call attention to ourselves.
Yeah.
These explosions.
Yeah, we're taking people hostage on like a, off of a major highway.
Mm-hmm.
People are definitely going to notice that. And then there's just like explosions going mm-hmm. on everywhere. And
mm-hmm. yeah,
I mean, Jesus, come on.
It was decided to leave the helicopters behind. In the chaos of the situation, the abandoned aircraft were not destroyed and documents that made it obvious that it was an American operation were left in the abandoned equipment. These documents included the detail, oh no, of operatives still in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
The helicopters were left behind and couldn't be set on fire because exploding ammunition in the choppers was a danger to the fixed-wing aircraft as they took off. The passengers on the captured bus were left behind, so they just, like, abandoned these people. A mission was planned to bomb the landing site, but the people from the Iranian bus were examining the helicopters, and the military were worried about retaliation being taken out on the Americans being held hostage if any civilians were killed. I love that their first thought was, well, we would kill them. The problem is, not, of course we wouldn't kill these civilians for our own stupidity, but never has America said that, except in this instance,
except
maybe.
In this one.
This was always going to be a high-risk mission. Rescuing just some of the hostages might have provoked the Iranians to kill any prisoners that they still had. This was a mixed force, and the combatants had never worked together before. Some of the pilots had never flown with night vision goggles before practicing for the mission. Jimmy Carter announced the failure the next day and took full responsibility for the mission.
What?
A president taking full responsibility for anything? That's new. Actually, it's old.
He was seriously like the last one to take full responsibility for anything.
Exactly. Operation Eagle Claw was criticized by a lot of armchair warriors. Some suggested that more helicopters should have been sent, disregarding the fact that the Nimitz would have had to carry them on the flight deck. The Kitty Hawk could have carried more, but it was being used as a decoy to keep the Soviets from guessing what was going on. The Soviets were keeping a close eye on the aircraft carrier and wouldn't have hesitated to inform the Iranians if they suspected anything. Others talked about the maintenance performed on the helicopters, but the real problem was the sandstorm and bad luck. The Pentagon inquiry into the mission found 23 areas that showed weaknesses. They noted that it was a high-risk operation and there was little margin to compensate for mistakes or bad luck. The major criticism was that the chain of command was unclear. They found that the lack of up-to-date weather information caused problems. They suggested that Air Force helicopter pilots might have been better qualified for the mission. Ayatollah Khomeini made a speech after the incident. He said, quote, "Who crushed Mr. Carter's helicopters? We did? The Sands did. They were God's agents. Wind is God's agent. These Sands are agents of God. They can try again," end quote. The intact helicopters left behind were used by the military after they had been recovered by the Iranians and given to the Iranian Navy. So I guess, like, well, thank you, United States military, for the gift of these helicopters.
Which obviously goes into why you destroy equipment.
Part of it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So they either can't use your tech and or copy your tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Almost as soon as Operation Eagle Claw was abandoned, planning began on Operation Snowbird. Rather than use helicopters, you know, they just start, like, clearly these military people just like coming up with names, but...
It's literally somebody's job.
Yes, yes, but like, might as well, like, where's Operation Pretty Pretty Princess? Because this is they're basically like, you know, their version.
There probably has been one.
Maybe.
Maybe. That we'll learn about, like, that happened in, like, 1996, and it will get declassified next year.
One of my favorite things is reading about the code names that the Secret Service gives various members of the First Family. Mm. I find that very amusing. Rather than use helicopter...
Shit for Brains is in the building. Like,
which one was that? Can you narrow it down?
To me, that would be Eric Trump.
I was thinking Baby Bush, but...
Oh, well, that works too. Yeah, pretty much works for...
Oh, if you had to come up with code names to the Trump family.
Then Don Jr.
Fuckface.
I was just going to... I swear to God, I was going to say the same thing. I was like, Don Jr. would be Fuckface.
Oh, no, his dad is Fuckface.
No.
I've branded him Fuckface.
No, his dad is like apparently... Registered trademark. His dad is apparently the smelly one.
Is that like a thing?
Things have come out recently about like how bad his BO is, which, I mean, he's 77 years old.
Mm-hmm. Well, but presumably, like, can afford for somebody else to bathe him if necessary.
No, but it's just like the shit that he wears. Like, he wears like a, but whatever. Like, a couple people have commented on it. But anyway.
Nice.
But yeah, shit for brains to me would be Eric, and yeah. Fuckface would be Don Jr. And then Crackhead would be our current president's son. Crackhead's in the building.
Oh boy. Rather than use helicopters, the rescue team would use C-130s and land in a soccer stadium. Rockets facing forwards and backwards would help the planes land and take off on such a short runway. Unfortunately, the rockets tore the wings off an aircraft during a flight test of the system, and the plane caught on fire. Yeah, I was gonna say
that doesn't sound like a
no, it actually doesn't.
It's like you either have to be they have to be in one place or the other. They can't be in You can't just like I don't know.
The flight crew escaped unharmed. That's good. The Iranians split up the hostages, and so a new rescue attempt was not really an option. There was no way Iran was going to let the prisoners free while Jimmy Carter was in power. Ronald Reagan milked the failure as much as he could. He was careful to point out that he couldn't disclose his, quote, cunning rescue plan, end quote, as that would tip off the Iranians. After 444 days of being held by the Iranians, the captives were set free within hours of Ronald Reagan coming into power. I'm sure that was pure coincidence. That was my addition there.
Well, and now, and I'm not even BSing on this, like, just last year or the year before, It came out, like, some of his people in the Pentagon, like, no, Reagan was totally doing back-channeling with Iran saying, don't anything until after the election.
Until after my inauguration.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, that used to be huge speculation.
Yes, it used to be conspiracy.
And now it's pretty much been confirmed, which would also be called treason.
Yep, that seems to be the thing that Republican presidents like to do the most is war crimes and treason. Not just Republicans.
I was going
to
say, it's not just Republican presidents. But the two confirmed cases that we have of it were both Republican presidents.
Yeah, funny how that works out. And that, my friends, is the story of Operation Eagle Claw by Stephen. Well done, as always, Stephen. Thank you.
What is that one YouTube channel I watch? Where he went into like a pretty deep dive of post-World War I into like 1950s Middle East. Because the Middle East was literally put together after World War I. There was all the... all these governments lost all this territory. All these new governments formed new territory. Mm-hmm. And the Allied powers were like, well, what are we going to do with this part of the land? And they basically, like, literally, that was part of what the Treaty of Versailles was in there somewhere about, like, okay, we're going to divvy up these lands. They didn't divvy up the lands. Okay, like, this tribe is this religion. They're like, no, we'll just divvy them up this way. Cut it, like, gave no...
Basically, a bunch of Westerners colonized, forced people into, hey, this is what it's going to be now.
So, I mean, you grew up, like, having a... Well, when I grew up, you hated the Soviet Union, because they were still in charge.
Right, because it was
the Cold War. And then that changed to, well, we don't have a real enemy. Let's just hate the Middle East. Like,
it's the whole easy. Middle East.
They're brown, so it's easier.
That's the ultimate thing, isn't it? Yeah. The Soviet Union was kind of the outlier because it's like, well, they're white.
They're like the whitest people on the fucking planet. Like, literally.
But they're communist.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Yeah. Communism is worse than being black or brown. And for America to say that is pretty...
Imagine being
damning.
A black communist. But
just ask the Black Panthers how that went.
We already know how that went down. I was gonna say you could ask Fred. What was his name?
Oh my God, we can't blank on his name.
No,
after...
jeez. But yeah, ask that. Oh wait, you can't because the FBI killed him.
Yep, literally. Oh my goodness, I can't believe I'm.
So this is the post-show banter for anybody that wants to bail.
I can't believe I'm
Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton.
Fred Black Panther.
Fred Black Panther.
Oh my God. He was 21 when he was assassinated.
And apparently, like, he was the real deal, too. Like, because other people, like on certain nights wanted to party and do drugs, and he was just like, no. Mm-hmm. He was like, we have to set, like the example.
Yeah.
So.
Imagine a mature 21-year-old. That's,
no shit,
that's
right? I mean, that's a miracle in itself.
Yeah.
But apparently, like, he was the real deal. And I listened to the Dollop did an episode on him, and I've listened to a couple of his speeches, and it's just like, this is a fucking 21... And the speeches that he gave, he was still only, I think, 19 or 20 years old.
Well, that's why they killed him. He was a threat. He was a major, major threat. That's the problem, is that...
So, like, the modern-day right-wing being, like... The FBI is woke. It's like, are you fucking serious?
Oh my
like,
God. Law enforcement is woke.
Like,
really?
Get the fuck
really?
Out of here. But anyway, Jesus. but back to the Middle East. Like, so when 9/11 happens, myself included, along with most Americans, were pretty like ignorant to our involvement in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Like, we really were. Mm-hmm. Not to say that 9/11 it did not need to happen in any form or fashion. Mm-hmm. But if you constantly get fucked with decade after decade, draining like your main resource, are you just going to always sit there and take it? Like, so is
not,
there,
not it, that that was the only motivation.
Right. And not that it's justified. What I'm saying is it's like you come out of it with a bit more of an understanding. Like if those buildings have been filled with Pentagon officials.
Well, and they did. They did try to attack.
Oh, well.
And they did partially attack the Pentagon.
Yes. But unfortunately, like, innocent people who had nothing to do with any of this fuckery always get caught in the crosshairs, and that's who...
Just like plenty of civilians in the Middle East got caught in the crosshairs.
Just like these guys, like, just rolling on the highway, I'm gonna go to the next town over. What the fuck? I'm being kidnapped. Like,
right, basically, yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Uh-huh.
But, like, and it's not just us, either. I mean, it's France... England, I mean...
A lot of world powers.
Yeah, the fuckery that has just gone on in that region for the past, I mean, at this point it's about 100 years, is just... it's like, what do you expect these people to do mm-hmm. after a while? Mm-hmm. I mean, really, mm-hmm. you know, so, mm-hmm. and we're never ever going to be on good terms with any of these countries. We're just not. Like, that ship has sailed.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, you can't fuck around with people for decades and then expect things to go well.
And all the things, like, the European powers and the Middle Eastern powers mm-hmm. predicted before our second go-around with having a war in Iraq, even though we're talking about Iran. Mm-hmm. But that whole, the war in Iraq completely destabilized that region as well. Mm-hmm. Just like everybody said it was going to. Mm-hmm. Iran was getting refugees, so was England, so, like, all these, so it's, and we're still, and if Trump becomes president, mm-hmm. he tried to fuck with Iran before he killed one of their top military leaders mm-hmm. when he was in office. Mm-hmm. We were this close to fucking going to war with Iran.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people forget that, but the war hawks that he's going to put in office if he does come back in, it's just... I don't know. I feel bad. I think it's important to know for people, especially the history of Iran. I'm glad Stephen went into that. Mm-hmm. Like, no, there is a reason that mm-hmm. that they hate us. It's not for no reason at all.
Right.
You know. So anyway, there's my drowning on
/ end rant.
Yes. So that was Operation Eagle Claw, from Stephen.
Yes.
Thank you very much once again, Stephen.
As always.
And this has been another episode of All Bad Things. I'm David.
I'm Rachel.
And we will see you next week.